This is Geek Speak, episode 25 of our 16th season. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles, what's up?
How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. We also have an iOS developer, designer, and software conference producer, Mr. Brian Young. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle.
Good to see you guys. It's been a while.
It's awesome to be here.
Yeah.
I've missed this.
How was WWDC?
Well, it was exciting.
I should say the San Francisco surrounding area.
Yes, I didn't get into the show. I didn't try to get into the lottery this year, but I did get to go up there for a day and talk to a ton of people, see a lot of people that I only know through Twitter and blogs. That was really cool.
And then, of course, is the Worldwide Developers Conference, which is so gratuitous of them to take that name, but basically it's Apple's developer conference. Last year, I actually got to attend a couple days, which was great. This year, I did not. But I have to say, since they were streaming all the talks, it was probably more productive to just sit in one location and watch them.
Well, it all depends why you go to these things. Because, I mean, it used to be there was big shows revolving around Macs and other computer vendors. But Macworld has been gone for a long time now. And really, this has become the big Mac Apple community event of the year, where people come in from all around the world to actually add a little worldwide to that name. And it's really, there's a lot of exciting stuff. Even if you don't get into the developer portion of the event, there's plenty of other events going on, that both free and paid, even design events.
Last week, in the middle of the WC, we recorded a show, and Miles talked very briefly about the new file system by Apple. We didn't get the chance to really dive into it, so today we're going to talk a little bit about file systems, but we're going to do that in a little bit. First, we're going to talk about some stories. Some news, that is, what's going on with China?
China has built the world's fastest supercomputer. Now, the thing is, they've had machines that went onto that top list before. I don't know if they were ever number one or not, but what makes this different is that they weren't using U.S. CPU chips anymore, or U.S. chips in general.
And normally, I mean, the big hitters in CPUs, of course, are AMD and, of course, Intel. And when you're talking about processors, normally they come from one of those companies. Apple, of course, also makes processors a bit for their own hardware. But you're saying that China made it without an Intel or an AMD or some other Motorola.
10.65 million compute cores built entirely with Chinese microprocessors.
Who are the Chinese what are the manufacturing names that do microcontrollers, microprocessors in China? Do you know the names?
Intel, AMD.
But those are not Chinese companies.
Right.
So do you know any Chinese companies that do this? I mean, I'm assuming that we actually use these chips all the time. We just don't know it. And that's my assumption, right?
Let's see. Sunway, Chiahu Light. I guess that's the one that...
That they use?
Oh, no, that's the name of the system. Mm-hmm. Not the manufacturer. I don't know the actual manufacturer, I'm afraid.
Pretty cool, though. They've made a supercomputer without our chips. I guess also when you think about supercomputers, you'd also throw in graphics cards, right?
Just over a year ago, the U.S. banned Intel from supplying Xeon chips to four of China's top supercomputing research centers.
Wait, are we in a supercomputing arms race with China? I mean, I think that's interesting because, of course, we have free trade to some degree with China, right? I guess not if there's restrictions on what we can send.
Well, there's always restrictions with some countries with regard to what tech goes out.
Right, like weapons, for example, a perfect example. We don't.
Yeah, well, weapons are severely restricted, but there are many times other technologies that are withheld.
And if we're talking supercomputers, I should also bring graphics card, right? NVIDIA is also a big manufacturer of supercomputers.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because, of course, parallel computing is a big piece of it. All right, kind of cool. Brian.
Hey, Lyle.
Tell us about how Apple's photo detection stuff. I've talked a lot about Google Photos on the show and how much I like being able to search for trees with dogs and actually see my pictures.
Yeah, so it was about a year
Apple
ago.
Apple does something similar to that, yeah.
Yeah, it was about a year ago that at Google I.O. they announced a bunch of exciting stuff, including this whole Photos product, which is completely online. You upload all your photos, it analyzes them, and you can search for an amazing amount of stuff. Right away, and it truly is amazing deep learning stuff. And lots of people have been concerned that Apple's strategy is going to leave them behind in the services area and not being able to do these
things.
What
did they announce at WWDC with regards to their photo? It's scene detection is normally what we talk about, object and scene detection.
Object and scene detection. So Apple has announced their own version of this product where they're going to be able to, in photos, either on your phone or on your Mac, detect a whole slew of scenes and objects as well. So it's very much like the Google product, although until we get to use it, we can't know how accurate it is or how amazingly good it could be or not.
So let's say they execute it really well. And it's comparable, if you will, to what I'm seeing in Google Photos. What's Apple's? Why is it?
So the fundamental difference here is that instead of using cloud computing to do all the analyzing, they're doing all the analyzing on the device. In fact, when you take the photo, they are able to analyze it as it's going to the SSD in the camera itself. And in that hardware. And then for all the photos that you've already taken, they are going to analyze those on device while your phone is plugged into the wall.
Why would you do this on device? Why not use the cloud service? It seems like from Google's perspective, they have to run their software at one location. It's probably some Linux machine farm, and it's spitting through things and categorizing them. And like, it also, as it builds its library, can kind of use that data to build its library better. So isn't that a better way of doing it than how Apple's doing it?
Well, I guess the proof is in the pudding. We won't know until we see how good Apple's scene object detection is. The really fascinating thing here is, everybody thinks about the enormous power that are on server farms and in the cloud data centers all around the world. It'll be interesting because there's also billions of phones floating around our world now that have incredible computing power as well. Mm-hmm. So when you take the combined computing of all of those phones and analyzing your own photos, they might be able to approach something that is certainly useful.
From a processing perspective, taking the photograph and doing it makes sense. I mean, these phones, Apple's phones and iPads and such, can play, pretty intensive 3D games. And most of the time, they are checking email. So we're not normally taking full advantage of the CPU and the graphics processing
the phone. You don't want to, though, because when you're walking around just on battery power, you don't want to burn that battery up. Mm-hmm. But the chips that are going into these things are pretty amazing, and they are approaching desktop capabilities.
And if you took...
I said approaching? This thing right here, this iPad Pro that I'm holding, is comparable to... one of the low-end laptops.
Chromebook? Yeah, totally.
A Chromebook? Yeah. Well, actually, I'd say it's more powerful than a Chromebook.
So there you go. But you did say desktop, not
I didn't
laptop.
Say a Xenon processor or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you did say desktop, and desktops are usually like your Core i5s,
laptops.
Core i7s, and those are...
You got me. That's not what I mean. But they are comparable to what we think of as... computer chips as opposed to mobile chips.
And with regards to the processing power, if you took 1,000 people and you processed all their photo libraries, you'd have to have a certain size farm to do that, to do it effectively. Or you could take those 1,000 people and they all have their own computer, which is their portable device, and the process themselves. So clearly the processing power has comparable qualities to it, the scale aspect of, as you add users, they add their own processing power to it. But that's not actually the core reason Apple's using devices for processing this data and doing scene selection.
Well,
what's the core reason they're doing that?
Of course, Apple's...
marketing arm of this, I guess.
I hesitate saying marketing because I actually think they really believe in it. Apple, of course, wants to keep data secure so that people trust using their devices for everything from their private photos to their financial records. Because the more you trust the device, the more you get to use it.
So if I took pictures of mushrooms, I was a mushroom person, I just went out and took all fungi photos, tons and tons of them. My phone would tag the photos as different types of fungi, mushrooms. Most times it would catch it because mushrooms look like mushrooms, maybe, depending on how good the algorithm is. That's determined. We don't know at this point. But Apple wouldn't know anything about that I was taking photos of mushrooms. They wouldn't have no idea because all that was doing on my device. If I instead took all those photos and I uploaded them to Google, Google would process them, detect mushrooms, and then they would know that I have photos of mushrooms. And then therefore might be able to sell me stuff through or advertise through me more directly because they know that I'm a mushroom hunter and therefore I might like these kind of boots and these kind of pants and all those kind of things.
So there's two sides to that. By intermingling all the data, the idea is that you're able to recognize more things mm-hmm. because you can use that data as your research lab to figure out what are the different things people want to know exist or can be recognized.
Well, the mushroom is a perfect example. If I take weird pictures of mushrooms, like mushrooms you don't normally see, their algorithms don't detect them. But then I say, no, this is a mushroom, and help the algorithm. Google could theoretically get faster at detecting mushrooms because so millions of people doing that.
You've used Google Photos more than I have.
I use it a lot.
Do you actually give it the names of things?
I give it names of people. Sometimes I help with the people side, but I find it a little creepy, so I don't do it very often. I don't think I've actually tagged stuff as trees. No, I think I have corrected and improved things. Yes. Yeah, definitely.
So you've taught it new things, or you've
no,
taught
it No, I mostly
it
removed things that it was wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
So all these learning algorithms, deep AI algorithms, I mean, they can't be absolutely perfect.
No, of course not.
Because humans even get this wrong.
Right.
And we're the most amazing pattern detection machines out there that we know of. But yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how Apple's works out. There are people that are looking into this that are trying to figure out how many different objects their algorithms are going to be able to detect. And right now, the early reports are looking like 4,000 or so different objects. The interesting thing is when they want to detect a place. Apparently, they're able to identify a proper name place, like, I don't know, San Jose, California, or Santa Cruz Beach, not by knowing the actual place name.
Geolocation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure there will be some geolocation that's involved in that, but they can also look at the kind of objects that are in the scene, and if a certain number of objects match, they can narrow it down to more and more, or yeah. fewer and fewer place names.
Well, I find it fascinating that Apple's going to try to challenge to do the same kind of thing without having the data. I think that is admirable. And if they even get at a 60% of what Google's doing with their photo app, I think that I would recommend, if you're an Apple user, using Apple's solution instead of Google's because of that joy of knowing it's private.
So
at the same time, Google offers free storage and backup, which Apple, of course, will not be able to do because they're not benefiting by getting the files located to their storage. So you basically have to pay for storage through Apple.
In fact, Apple's notoriously high-priced for their online storage.
They are.
Okay, so I have been a longtime Apple fan. I mean, I go back to the Apple IIe days. I bought my first Mac when I was just a high school kid.
Yeah, okay, yeah, we get
yeah,
it.
But I'm totally all in on Apple, and I recognize it. So I'm totally believing that they believe in privacy as a moral ideal, not as just a marketing thing. But what about you? Do you accept them at face value, or do you think this is a lot of just trying to position themselves?
I think they definitely promote it because it's a beneficial thing to say. But no, I believe that when you look, if I were to analyze from inside Apple, if I was to work there and look at the strengths that Apple has traditionally versus other companies and wanted to differential myself to sell myself, you know, to sell the business, one of the things I would notice is that, wow, we actually make money from the things we sell, not by selling data. And other companies make money by selling data. Facebook makes money by selling advertising. Google makes money by selling advertising. And therefore, Apple's strength in its sense that it's stronger than other places is its privacy capabilities. So the more they produce that strength and harden it, the more effective they'll get customers that believe and care about that. And I think in the revelation of Snowden's revelation of how much our government searches and looks through our data, I think people want a bit of that privacy. It's fear-mongering too, potentially. So there's a side where I'd be careful about how much they say, but I don't see that in their language. I mostly say, look, we can do this with privacy involved, and that's what we're going to do. So yeah. I believe in it.
Principles are much easier when your paycheck is not dependent upon it. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. They're making a lot of money the way they're doing it by just having really high margins.
Well, yeah, but it totally is conceivable that someday Google is going to eclipse them on what they can offer because of all the intermingling of all the different data they have on a user and all the predictive things that they could make that are helpful.
Well, one of the things I did want to mention was in the past you said Apple's is more expensive than Google's. And I don't know that that is true. Because it depends on what you consider for sale. Like, for example, if you're just spending money just at a dollar value, yes, Apple requires you to spend more money. But with regard to, as we were talking about with ads, you cease to be the customer, and the company who's buying the ad is the customer. You are the product. So you end up selling not your money, but you sell your buying habits, your
Sure, you're paying your interest. Way.
Yeah. You're paying either way.
Okay, what you're saying, your point was that for Google, I can automatically have all my photos updated at a lower resolution than the full quality and saved forever and free. But with Apple, I have to pay monthly. And what you're saying was, well, actually, you're paying monthly for Google too. You're just paying it a different way.
Yes.
It's kind of common. Yeah, I agree.
You know what's really funny about that? I don't know when this was, maybe 2008 or so. My wife really wanted a computer and we didn't have money at the time. And at the time there was all these services where you could go and look at all the ads that they put in front of you. And once you, choose to sign up for a few free or partially low paid kind of deals, then you would earn enough points that they would send you a MacBook, one of these white MacBooks. And we totally did it. I went through all of them and, we actually got the device and I was thinking, wow, this really was cheap. But the spam I got after that.
You paid.
I paid dearly.
iPhone I ever got was that pattern because I already had a functional phone. I didn't need a phone, but I wanted an iPhone. And I went ahead and went, well, if I don't pay for it, it's okay. And so I did some thing where I think I had to share. I think I had a like pyramid thing where I had to share it with people. Really annoying. And I did and got the free phone. I've never done that since, but that was
that the 4 gig original one?
Yeah,
that
the first
got rid of.
Well, no, it was a iPhone 1, whatever that was.
Yeah, it was the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I remember you got a 4 gig one, and then you saw that, oh, wait, there's an 8 gig one, and it's like the same price. I'm going to tell the person I don't want it.
Is that what I did?
The new one, yeah.
It's true, I did that.
Yeah, anyways, the company isn't in business anymore either. I don't think they survived another year after I used them.
Yeah, it seems like it might not survive very well. Hey, this is Geek Speak, obviously, and Miles and Brian and I are all chatting, and I want to just... let you know that you can contribute to the program if you'd like. We're independent now, and of course, we'd love your contributions, as some people do. We have a Patreon page, and I want to thank Chris Irwin and Pat Hedder for participating. They give money every month, and so I thank them every episode. And you can as well just go to geekspeak.org/support to learn all about that. All right, Miles, I feel like it's your turn. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I got enough stories.
Yeah, you sure do, man.
We're not getting
some
all your
brain
stories
training
tonight.
Thing. What's this?
Yes,
brain training?
It's a very popular thing. People will buy an app, and it will say, you know, practice your memory, and you'll keep it active, and you'll keep it fresh and new, or do these brain teasers, and it'll keep your brain in fit and in shape, and so when you get older, you know, you won't suffer from dementia and other brain-related diseases, or at least it'll slow it down.
Sounds great.
Yeah, except that, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I figured you were going to say that.
So somebody actually
did
research.
It's a billion-dollar industry.
It is.
But when a study took a look at it, it was nothing but placebo effect.
This is why I'm not a good business person, because I could definitely make one of those. Like, that would be not a problem to make one of those brain training games, right? iOS app, whatever, and charge some money and maybe make some money on it. But now that I know there's no viability behind it, I couldn't do it. Lousy business person.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. When we were talking about my wife and I were talking about stuff on the farm selling, you know, eggs and whatnot, you just can't get – there's not much margin there.
Right.
And when she, you know, goes to, you know, grow squash or whatever, like that's a staple food. That's something that people can make you can produce a whole lot of it, and then people, you know, can survive
on it. Squash grows fast, yeah.
Yes, except that you don't pay that much for it.
No.
But she plants edible flowers, and suddenly it's much more lucrative. It's like you don't really live on the flowers. They're mostly just not toxic. Well, you put them on as a garnish on top of a dish to make them more pretty.
That's great marketing. It's not toxic when you can eat it.
Eat it for nutrition. You don't eat the flowers so that you can, you know, bulk up.
That's not the only reason you eat, though. I mean, come on. But I love having flowers from the garden on things like salad. It makes it all pretty. Or cakes. It's great.
That's what I mean. They are an aesthetic thing as opposed to I will starve if I don't eat the staple food.
Let me ask this. Those flowers are really light in weight. There's not a lot of mass to them, right?
Right.
So how do you actually sell them? By little baggies? Is it like a drug deal gone bad? What do you do? Like sell?
No. I'm not going to get into the business model of edible flowers right now. I just wanted to talk about fact that
it's great.
Getting something that is this ornate or somewhat interesting or off the beaten path, even if you take something that's normal and then you dress it up in a certain way, like people who are selling peaches that have miniature versions of women's panties on them so it looks like little butts.
Oh, God.
Exactly. It doesn't cost that much. There's not, but there's such a novelty. You can charge like five times as much as you would for a normal peach.
Miles is a better business person than me. All right.
No, I'm not saying I would do it. I'm just talking about how it's a curious thing about human behavior that the novelty, we pay more for novelty than we do for necessity.
Yeah, I think that's true. Let's move on. Miles.
It's the computer industry.
Miles, you know a bit about file systems, more so than me. And Apple's released this new, or said they're going to release a new file system. What's the deal? Is it any good? I mean, what are they doing? Why are they doing it? Let's talk a bit about file systems.
So normally what a file system has to do with, like for folks who start off with DOS or CPM or something like that, you have the file location table. It's something that's actually been on zip drive, or not zip drives, thumb drives for quite a while.
Thumb drives?
Yeah.
Until it got too big. File allocation table?
Yes. And that really was just this quick little, all right, here's the file at the very beginning. You have a file allocation table that says, here's the file name, here's the offset where it exists on the disk, and this is how big it is.
Wow. So like memory addressing.
Yes. Yeah, okay. It's basically a bitmap.
All right.
Yeah.
So basically, there's a whole bunch of storage on device. There's no structure to it, really, except for a whole bunch of ones and zeros. And the very beginning of it, you have like a file, basically, which you're calling a table. It's a lookup thing. And it basically has a list of items. It has the file name, and then the memory location, and then the length of the memory.
Right.
And effectively, as you add and remove stuff to that list, as you have to remove stuff to the tape, to the file system, the hard drive, the storage medium, you modify that list. And as long as you read that list and do it correctly, everything's fine. That's like a really basic file system.
Yes. And the reason why you have to have a file system is because a hard drive to the system looks very much like this large sequence of bytes. Like, so if you have a gigabyte hard drive, I realize that's not quite what we have anymore. Like 1 terabyte, I guess, would be more likely. That's 1 trillion bytes, plus or minus. Mm-hmm. And that's not useful. You need to organize it in some way. You need to have a card catalog or something like that. It's like in the library. You need to have some way of organizing stuff to say this goes into this section, and then you can look up by number and by author and whatnot.
Yeah, just like an index in the back of a book. Okay, so I remember hearing people talk about the early days of their computing career, and I remember somebody saying, yeah, and they went in and they were converting their FAT volume into an NTFS volume, and something went terribly wrong, and they had to go in and manually rebuild their allocation tables, and they were going in and actually editing in a hex editor and stuff like that. But
Partition tables, most likely.
The partition tables. So all of this stuff is just data on the disk, just to make sense of where your files are. And if you got geeky enough, you can get down there and hack it at that level, right?
Well, yes. I mean, there is nothing magical about computers, even the most advanced ones. But they're all just a series of steps and they get to such minutiae that no one really wants to delve into that anymore for day-to-day use.
But once you get to the point where you have a corrupted disk, which I haven't seen in ages, have you guys had anything
spinning
corrupted?
Rust? Yeah, that goes bad all the time.
Well, I've had not the medium go bad, but I've actually had the format of the disk go bad, where I don't think it was because the actual Rust had failed.
Right. Okay, and that is actually not to do with the media per se. That's getting on to file systems have evolved over time, and you have things known as journaling file systems. And what they do is they have a separate place to hold the information for what it's about to write, and then it's going to write it, and then it writes the equivalent of that file allocation table, although that's not really what many of them do. They have these
more complicated systems.
Inodes, yeah.
But journal is a record of what you're about to do and then whether you've done it or not.
Right.
And so what it allows you to do is make transactions on the drive safer.
Yeah, it's a write-ahead log. So then if something goes wrong and the file system is in a
unknown state.
Yeah, unknown state. Yeah, thank you.
So this stuff's
then it goes back to that write-ahead log, that journal, and says, okay, what was I doing? And let me look at the file system, how it correlates. Oh, this one didn't complete. Let me remove that. And now my file system is back in a known state.
So this stuff's been around for a long time. I mean,
journaling and such.
Yeah, journaling and file systems. Let's see. When did I first start playing? I guess those would have been the late 90s.
So before that, hard drives were much more fragile. In some sense, right? The writing of it. If you were writing and you unplugged it and plugged it back in, your hard drive could potentially be completely corrupted.
Yeah. File location table, like back in DOS days, if you turned the machine off while you were writing to the drive, you ended up with like, I can't boot to disk. And you had to go through this whole thing. People are familiar, I'm sure, with the application check disk.
Yeah.
That you ran it and then you waited, you know.
And it basically would walk
30
through
minutes, anywhere between 30 minutes and 3 hours.
And it's just confirming that all the things in the index actually exist on the drive.
Yeah, it's just walking through the entire drive and looking to see does everything match up, and it'll find things like, hey, this doesn't point to anything anymore. Let's clear that out.
So the reason why I was trying to get my head wrapped around all this is Apple is making a new file system, and it sounds like it has a lot of the features that ZFS has in it, although certainly not all of them.
We haven't talked about ZFS yet, so yeah. We can back up to that.
And you mentioned last week BetterFS?
BTRFS.
BTRFS.
But it's either referred to as BetterFS or BetterFS. BetterFS.
Well, let's back up for a second and ask, what is Apple currently, on my Mac right now, what am I currently using as the file system?
You're using HFS Plus, which is a variation of HFS, which was a file system that Apple used more than a decade ago.
No, more actually 30 years ago. It came out 2 years after the first Mac, so 86.
Okay. And so HFS, I know that it has journaling because I can check that box.
No, HFS Plus does. HFS, the original, did not.
Okay. No, and the other thing it does is...
That's why it's called a Plus. They started patching this stuff on top of it. Also.
There's a bit of complication on the file system that I currently use in that sometimes you can have it case sensitive and sometimes it's not case sensitive. Mm-hmm. And you have to specify to be case sensitive if you want it to be. And if you do that, some applications will crash. So I know this because I was trying to make hard links across the system. So those kind of anomalies of the file system are part of the reason why HFS is crusty. But what's like the main reason why you want to get rid of HFS Plus? Like what is it lacking?
Well, HFS Plus is basically taking HFS and then patching in things like journaling, patching in things like, you know, some redundancy and recovery, and patching in some things like better able to handle RAID volumes, a redundant array of independent disks, so multiple drives acting as one.
So as those features, they wanted them, like journaling and stuff, they modified the spec a little bit and changed it. They didn't like rebuild from scratch.
Right.
So it has cruft, like any complicated system grows over time.
Yeah.
So is that like the main reason is to make
it? I believe so. I believe that was the case.
Brian, someone that you and I listen to regularly is always saying Apple needs a new file system. Who is that?
That would be John Siracusa.
And he never really says why he needs it. I've never heard him say
one of his most fundamental reasons is actually not addressed by the new file system at all.
That's hilarious.
I don't know. Have you guys ever had a file just go bad on you? Like you haven't looked at it in like, I don't know, 5 years, you're trying to watch the movie and it starts playing and all of a sudden it just craps out.
And you don't know how long it's been bad. Like you might have backups of a few months, but you might have a bad backup.
Right.
Right.
So when a file is copied on most of these file systems, it just reads in all the data and it writes it to another place. And it doesn't confirm that what the drive was told to write is actually there on the medium. Mm. So to do that, they would have to actually reread all the data it just wrote and confirm that that's the same data it expected.
Mm-hmm. Seems like a pretty fundamental need for a file system.
Yeah, actually, I'm pretty worried about it because I've had enough files go bad on me. And especially... I don't know if I absolutely need it on my main drive that the computer is running on, but certainly the backup disks should be like that, shouldn't they?
Yeah, you think so. I'm sure some of the backup software does that. Okay, a long time ago, you told me a whole bunch about ZFS. It was like your baby for a few years on Geekspeak. I'm sure we talked about it because you loved ZFS. Why did you love ZFS? What was it doing why should I care?
Well, there are other operating systems that do these things as well, but ZFS...
You mean other file systems?
There are other file systems out there. I mean, thinking of journaling file systems back in the day, there were things like JFS, XFS, JFS made by IBM, XFS made by SGI, that all had different pluses and minuses. XFS was actually really fast with regard to media because it didn't – if you went to write a file and then you immediately deleted it afterwards, which is a very common thing in multimedia editing, if – it would save stuff in the buffer, and then if by the time it went to write to the drive, you had already deleted it, it never actually wrote to the disk.
Oh, nice.
Which means that you kept everything in memory. So things like that.
Constantly when I'm dealing with audio processing, audio editing of the show, the system is always kind of generating stuff for me on the back end so mm-hmm. that it can autoplay the file. But as I change settings, filters, whatever, the stuff that it was generated should just be tossed. And so if that had to go to disk and come back, that would all be slower.
Right.
So if I had a system that did that, it'd be better.
So right. This is where the hardware is being taken advantage of by the file system. The file system knows that there's a buffer in the drive that a long
it's not
time...
the buffer in the drive. It's actually a buffer kept in RAM.
Oh, okay. It's the file
system
keeping
RAM.
Its
yeah,
own
the operating
buffer.
System is fully in control there.
Okay, so I asked about ZFS. What do you like about ZFS?
So ZFS does something which you were alluding to before, Brian, which is what is called hashing or checksumming, which is figuring out, does this file not only exist on the drive, but is it also correct? Is it the same file that I looked at the last time? And so the file system for ZFS and for some others like BetterFS, and I believe APFS is going to do this as well, the new Apple file system.
No.
It won't do this?
Not
yet.
Check something? Okay. It may be added in the future, but that's not an initial feature.
That's a shame because that's actually a really necessary
Describe
item.
It. What is it? What is it?
So like I said, it's looking at the file and you're generating a number.
Mm-hmm. A hash, like a hash, like anything.
Yes.
So mathematically calculating against all the bits in there and getting a number that basically could only be produced by that data.
You figure out the length of the file and you figure out this hash, and if the length and the hash are the same, that file is,
it's exactly
mathematically
the same.
Has to be the same.
There's always a possibility of collision because you're talking about really large files. But at the same
time,
from all
practical sense of the size of the universe and all that, it is exactly the same file that you wrote the first time.
Right.
So the basic idea is that built into the file system, every single file will have a hash. So if it gets changed, corrupted, you would know right away that it was changed. It was some way to compare.
As soon as you were making a backup, you would know, hey, wait a second, this is not going to be a good file anymore. You need to get a backup.
Cool.
You need to restore from backup.
Anything else that ZFS does that you thought was beneficial?
It gets rid of the RAID write hole.
What's the RAID write hole?
So
first off, RAID in general ideas is, let's say, a hard drive can fail and also has a certain amount of cap on speed to write and to read. So you can configure hard drives in multiple different patterns where you can say, well, I want to have three hard drives and I want to write to the first one a little bit, the second one, and the third one in like a striped format, and therefore your write speed is really, really fast. Or you can say, I want these two drives to be exactly the same, and every time you write from them, they're exactly the same. So if one fails, you're fine. And there's a whole bunch of different patterns to do that, and they're all called RAID.
Right. And RAID 1, which is two drives that are writing the exact same thing, is known as mirroring. And that's actually not where the write hole occurs. The write hole generally occurs on RAID 5, things like that.
RAID 5 is awesome, by the way. But go on.
Well, yeah.
It's except for the hole.
I actually am a big proponent of mirroring, especially for
Well, nowadays, especially with hard drives the way they are, yeah.
But so there you have, let's say you have five drives. Actually, RAID 5, you can do as little as three.
You can have three drives, yeah.
And so it writes 1/4 of a file on one drive on each drive, and then on the last drive it has a parity. Actually, it's not on the last drive. They
strike
parity
across the three
goes all around. But so 1/4 of your file exists on any given drive.
In a five drive system.
Yeah.
And the 3-1 is actually easiest to do, but the three way to think about it is the easiest way because it's the most minimum.
Okay.
So you have half the file, half of everything on one drive and half on another drive, and then the third one actually has a diff of the two.
Right.
So any of the drives could be lost, effectively.
Yeah, now the good part is that if any one drive goes away, you have enough information to recreate what data is missing from mm-hmm. that missing drive. And that's one of the advantages of it.
How does ZFS help in this situation?
Hold on. This is kind of complicated. Now, one of the problems with that is that if a drive goes down while you're in the process of writing data, that intermediate, that unknown state that you have with a single drive becomes an even bigger issue.
Yeah.
Because you have multiple drives to have to manage and keep together and what was the current state for them. And so many people would buy these cards, add-in cards onto their computers that have a battery backup. They're a RAID controller.
Oh, yeah.
So it isn't the operating system controlling the RAID. It's this external device that has a battery backup so that if you tell it to write something and then their system crashes for some reason, either the power goes out or operating system crashes, that it has enough power in that battery to be able to finish the operation to the drives and leave them in a consistent state. But there is still a window of opportunity for something bad to happen. Because you also have this problem where the operating system doesn't know what the card is doing. It doesn't know how the files are actually laid out on disk. It doesn't know what it should be watching out for. And so many people will do what's called a software raid. And there the operating system is doing the raid, but then you don't have the battery backup.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have all sorts of problems with that. ZFS got rid of this notion of, well, I'm going to have a logical volume layer, which says I'm going to be able to resize this file system as big as I want, how many drives I want, from the actual splitting of the physical disks.
It separated those things out into two conceptual.
It used to be separated out.
Okay.
And they had to be.
Okay.
The operating system can deal with logical volume management, and the hardware was the multiple drives. ZFS combined them, which some people were like, wait, you're combining all of these different layers together? Wait, this is not okay. And what it did was they were able to get rid of certain assumptions and get rid of that write hole. In other words, even without a dedicated hardware card, you can use commodity hardware onto your motherboard that's connecting mm-hmm. up through your SATA ports or whatever. And you don't have any worries about the consistency of your file system, even in the case of a power outage or
because the file system itself or operating system, if you think of it that way, knows what is confirmed to be on that drive.
The hardware volume management and the logical software volume management are one and the same. So the right hand knows what the left hand is doing.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. We definitely went down a deep rabbit hole for that one. That was awesome. I love it. I hope you're still with us listening. If not, tune back in because we're here now. So have you reviewed what Apple's file system is doing, the new one?
Apparently not, because I thought that it had...
Well, you fill us in a little bit.
So I got kind of excited about this and got into it. First of all, to correct or to flesh out what I was saying, it doesn't include a checksum, a way to verify that the data was written. It does include a checksum of metadata. So all of the extra information about a file, its permissions, its tags, any metadata about it is checksummed, written, and can be confirmed.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that's why what you might have read.
Doing the hash and checksum of all files actually can be a performance issue, right?
You have to calculate that stuff. You really want to do it if you're going to do it because right. you're going to slow things down.
The other
down.
Thing
but
about this file system is they haven't actually released it.
No.
Right? It's temporary. It's beta right now.
They say it'll be released in 2017, but if this is this kind of software, you want to make sure it's really darn good.
Right,
Core. Yeah, everything you're doing relies on it. So yeah, I would be quite happy if they took longer. But there's some interesting features to it, which are totally different than file systems I've known about before. So file systems that I've known about before are based on the idea that there's a hard drive. There's a spinning disk in there. And there's the idea of fragmentation where you want to have bytes pretty much of one file all in a row on the media so that the drive can quickly read it and write it and fragmentation can slow you down.
And that really has to do with being able to have the head be physically in one location of the track of the drive because it's like a record.
The more it
and
has it, to jump the, around, the, right, slower the slower things will be.
Right, because physical hard drives actually take time to go between sectors and move around.
Yeah, and there's been lots of things to mitigate this in over the years. But this file system is based on the idea that it's going to be flash storage where it doesn't have to worry about contiguous space in the same way. So what they've done, I said in the same way. I qualified myself there, Miles. So what they've done is when you make, say, two partitions on your drive, on most file systems, it literally blocks off one big part of the drive to be one partition, another big part of the drive to be another, and they're pretty much physical locations, the way I understand it.
That used to be the case with hard drives. It is really no longer the case anymore. Modern
right.
hard drives, along with SSDs, the operating system really does not know the physical mapping.
Okay, but when you write to, say you have a 100 gigabyte drive and you make two partitions that are both 50 gigabytes mm-hmm. and you start filling up one of those and you want to expand one and shrink the other, you have to go through this process of rewriting the partition table.
You used to about 20 or 30 years ago. You do not anymore.
Well, okay. Well, HFS Plus is definitely coming from that generation. So one cool thing about the Apple mm-hmm. file system they're working on now is that when you make two, well, I'll call them partitions. They use a different term that are on this 1 gigabyte drive or 100 gigabyte drive. Both partitions are shown as 100 gigabytes. And as you fill up one of those, both of them are reduced in the size that they mm-hmm. report. But if you were to just say, oh, I've got two 100 gigabyte partitions here and add it up, you've got 200 gigabytes on a 100 gigabyte drive.
Problematic.
Well, problematic, but at the same time, you don't have to worry about any idea of repartitioning because as you write to it, it knows which logical volume contains which data, even though it's all on one
right.
drive.
This is one area where it becomes difficult when you're coming from a Mac because Mac shields you from so many of these niggling details. We are talking about different things. We're talking about the physical hardware layer. Then there's the logical volume manager, which is that partition management.
Size management.
And then you have the file system on top of that. So that, yeah, which is what ZFS like puts all together.
I have a four drive Drobo, which is a FireWire storage medium, RAID actually, mm-hmm. a storage medium. And you connect up to your computer and you see the size of it. And when you can actually set the size of that volume to be really large, even if you don't have enough hard drives in there, with the idea that if your file system starts filling it up, this other piece of software runs and says, hey, you need to put another drive in. And then you take your 1 terabyte drive out and you put a 2 terabyte in that slot, and the drive can actually fill itself back up, right? So you can continually grow it over time. I personally hate that feature. I want the operating system to know exactly how much space is available. I don't like that it's lying. It says it's 16 gigs, even though or 16 terabytes, even though I only have 2 terabytes. I find that aggravating. But then again, if it's Apple doing this with what you're talking about, they would actually have the file system, the operating system would actually understand what it meant to have different partitions of physical size and wouldn't probably over-lie to you, wouldn't say you had 200 gigabytes even though you only had 100.
Well, that's only if the user is like adding that up in their head. I'm sure if you ask the computer to give you the answer, it would give you something that makes sense.
Right.
At least they're going to have to make it do that.
But in this situation with Drobo, it doesn't make sense. It would have to have a separate piece of software that tells you, which is what, of course, they offer.
Right.
By the way, I have another Drobo unit, a network-attached Drobo that I haven't set up, and I'm supposed to kind of play with it and review it for the program and maybe invite the people that work on Drobo onto the show.
Okay, yeah.
Now, do that at some point.
A quick addendum about checksumming. Now, that is disappointing that they don't do checksumming. And Apple's rationale for this, I just read, is the fact that they have error checking and correction built into their storage, their SSDs. And so they say, we're not getting bad data back because the drive is already catching any of those errors.
That's clever.
Which there is some utility to that, except that one of the things about having a checksumming file system is that it allows you to make wicked fast backups.
Yes.
So when you have something like Time Machine, the backup software utility for Macs, I have a time capsule, the Apple brand time capsule.
It's a piece of hardware.
Yes, that has a hard drive. And so every hour or so, my laptop will have a little spinning thing and it goes, oh, look, you have 50 megabytes of change. I'm going to just change that. But there's always this spinning where it says, first I'm going to look and see if anything has changed. And that takes a fairly long period of time. Then it goes, okay, and then here's the 50 megabytes.
Right.
And then you have now I'm cleaning up.
Because effectively what you have to do is you have to say, well, new files are one thing, but changed files are something completely different, right? You got to say, oh, this file is different possibly between the two machines. You have to kind of read them and look at them, inspect them. And that's exactly what the file system hash is a representation of exact unity or uniqueness of that file. Mm-hmm. So you're saying if it's built in, then backups can just go checksums, check. Oh, these two checksums are different. All right, make a new copy.
Right.
Very cool.
And for that matter, it's able to see ZFS does a checksum on block level, not mm-hmm. file level. So if you have a 4 gigabyte file, that's not a single checksum. I mean, there is a single checksum for the entire one, but there's also checksums for every single piece, which is usually on the order of, what's a typical block size? 4 kilobytes?
4K, I think.
Yeah.
That might be old sizes. I don't know. That's less than my.
No, they're probably larger than that at this point. But
you can actually change that too, depending on what you want.
No, 4K. No, not 4K. 4 megabytes. I believe they're.
Isn't it funny how the sizes, as sizes get larger, you get lost in what scale you're at?
Yeah, yeah.
It's lovely.
That and I learned a lot of this stuff when drives were so much smaller. So a lot of my data ends up being out of date.
Right, a 20 gig hard drive was a big hard drive. Yeah.
Okay, so.
So you're saying that the individual blocks of the file only might, maybe one of the blocks was changed. And now you can actually do a copy by just copying from one system to the other for the backup, just copy that one block.
Right. And that's one thing that the company rsync.net does with ZFS is if you have ZFS on both ends where it can do some checksumming, it can just say like, oh, which blocks have changed? And if you make, you know, a twiddle a bit on a 4 gigabyte file, if you do that with Time Machine, that means you're going to be sitting there for a while as it goes and checksums that 4 gigabyte file, then sees that something has changed. It doesn't know what, and it copies the entire 4 gigabytes over the network again to make that backup.
Sure. Makes sense.
Whereas with ZFS, it goes, oh, this block changed. Copy over a megabyte.
Right. Very cool.
And do it so much faster. That cleanup and startup setup takes so much less time. So
faster in one blazingly fast way, and slower in some other ways if you use that feature.
Right.
Now, there is one thing that's kind of comparable, though it doesn't work cross-disk. Apple File System, supposedly, it'll only copy on write, which means if you have a file and you'd make a copy of it, say it's my video of GeekSpeak, and I make a copy of it, it'll be a blazingly fast copy because as far as the file system goes, it's just saying this one chunk of data now exists in two places.
You're creating a new card for the card catalog, but there's only one book.
Right. But then I read that into my video editing software and I save it. When I save it, it's not overwriting that one file. It's now making a copy of a second file, and now it exists in two places in two different states.
Now, does it make a full copy of the file again, or is it making a differential copy?
So I haven't gotten a full answer of that. Right. I've seen enough that makes me think it's going to be at block level.
Yeah. Okay. So we could have speed and performance. I mean, video encoding, that's a little different, but maybe large text files.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it depends on what you do to the file, I guess, if you clip it or something.
But this also opens up snapshotting, which is something that I think NTFS has had for a long time, where you can just go about your business and all these files are going to change and you can still get back to the previous state of the file.
Actually, I don't recall that NTFS had snapshotting.
I know Windows itself has some sort of snapshotting facility.
They may have added that after the fact. The original NTFS most certainly did not.
And NTFS is the new technology file system. It came out with NT.
With Windows NT. NT, which it's the NT file system, yeah.
Right. And NTFS actually it has a protocol form of it, and that has actually become one of the de facto networking protocols, NTFS. And that's the thing that's odd about file systems and file system protocols. Like Apple for a long time has said AFP, which is Apple File Protocol, and then there's NTFS, and of course Apple can speak both of those. Windows machines cannot speak AFP unless you install something that you probably shouldn't do. When you're dealing with Windows and Macs, doing this kind of thing is kind of problematic. So they're not changing AFP. They're just changing the file system at the hardware level, not the protocol itself. Do you know much about protocols? We save that for another show?
What protocol? I mean,
well, NTFS versus AFP. I'm just curious.
NTFS is not the protocol. Samba.
SMB. Is it Samba? Called Samba? Is it Samba?
Well, Samba is the open source version, and that was a play on the fact that it was SMB, server message block, and also CIFS, which was, I forget what the acronym stands for, but SMB, CIFS tend to be interchangeable when people talk about them. They're the Windows file sharing.
Okay, sorry, I misspoke. NTFS is the file system, not the protocol.
Right.
All right. I think we should move on from file systems. Are we good, Brian?
That out. No, there's many more features, but that's fine.
What I realize is that we don't...
We didn't talk about snapshotting, though.
All right, let's go. Okay.
So snapshotting. That one's very simple to explain.
Okay.
You have your file system, you have your drive as it exists with all the files on it, and you say, all right, take a snapshot, which is like taking a photo of like what's the files, what are all the files at this particular moment in time.
And when you're doing this, you actually have another target location that you put the snapshot.
No, on the same the same drive.
All right.
And then when you change a file, you can either roll back to the existing snapshot, which is a very fast operation, or you can create a new snapshot, and it will go very fast. It just says what's the new one, and it doesn't create a whole new copy of all of your files. It just uses the space for keeping track of all the files that have
changed.
Well, a copy of the file allocation table, or the equivalent therein, and then with a little extra for the file pointers, the inode pointers to the data itself.
Nope, I don't got it. Do it again.
Okay, so you have a card catalog, and it goes to all of the books.
In the library.
Right. Now you take away a few books.
Wait, you say a snapshot. Now you've set something in motion that says snapshot start.
Yes. And so that is the card catalog that you have.
Okay.
So you say, okay, you put all of those cards in a vault.
Okay.
And then you start adding and removing books.
And modifying some other card system, a copy of the card system?
Right. Okay. And so then the next snapshot will take the existing one, and then you go to see what has changed, and you have a differential, basically.
So you're basically doing a differential of the index system, not the actual files.
But you're also keeping a file system pointer to the byte data.
Okay. So if I went ahead and erased a book from the library after the snapshots happened, the file system will say from here on out, after that snapshot, it will say, oh, that book is no longer there. But in reality, it holds on to the memory and the drive, and the old index has it.
Yes.
So if you want to say go back to it, you're good. So basically, you're kind of like protecting the books by saying you delete them, but really you hide them.
Right, which means that over time, as you go through a lot of drive churn, you will have to remove some snapshots or your drive will fill up.
Yeah, and also it gets crusty, right? It takes longer to do snapshots?
No, not really.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, snapshots are very, very fast compared to general backups. So the idea being, like for example, with rsync.net, when they have ZFS on both ends, imagine you do a checksum, you figure out which files have changed, you just copy those blocks that are necessary, and then on the server side, you make a snapshot. Which means at any moment in time, you could go back and get...
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I can see why you like ZFS.
It's just like Time Machine how it should be.
how it should be. And I actually thought it was. I thought they had hooks in the operating system to know what files had changed when they announced
this.
They
do. And when you're going over AFP and HFS Plus, it's on the Time Machine, you're using what are called hard links.
Yeah.
And so when a file hasn't changed, you just have a single entry that points to...
Isn't that a file system? Entries. Isn't that an operating system? That's an operating system level lock, right?
Yeah, right. Okay. But that's how you're able to have all these Time Machine backups without having the drive fill up so fast.
Okay, I'm going to ask for you to give kind of an educated guess. Why did Apple not go with something like ZFS or BetterFS, instead make their own?
BetterFS, I believe, is GPL, GNU Public
that
License.
Could be a
problem. I believe that would rule it out. ZFS is the Sun Community License, or it's BSD licensed.
It's a license issue?
No, I don't think that prevented them. They could have, and that's what a lot of people were expecting them to.
So they worked on adding ZFS to the operating system for years, and they stopped that development 7 years ago, from what I've been reading. In fact, some people think that it was just a political fight inside of Apple, that since ZFS was made for server-level kind of drive support, that really it might not scale down to a watch, which they're going to use this file system on all of their devices.
Well, Apple also has multimedia devices. It may be that ZFS isn't tuned for multimedia systems, and they had some problems with latency, because latency response with regard to how quickly are you able to read or write from a drive becomes important.
Yeah,
at the file system level.
And one author I read also thinks that people just weren't happy with the licensing, and they use that as an excuse to make their own.
Yeah. The other one is that APFS may have been designed so that it can run on whatever device you want. In other words, you could use APFS on an iPhone versus
a
laptop.
That is their intention. Their intention.
So that may be an issue where ZFS may have just been
too bloaty.
Just not the right tool for the purpose. Yeah.
All right. Good. Thank you guys for talking about file systems. We'll have to do it again. I think it's fascinating. Hey, we quote the EFF and we always read articles from them and say, oh my gosh, you got to act now because bad, bad, bad. Because EFF is like watching our back online. It's, of course, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. But this last week, on June 14th, actually, they wanted to say congratulations to us, Go Team Internet, because one of the things that the EFF has been fighting for succeeded. And that is, on June 14th, the Federal Appeals Court upheld clear net neutrality rules that will let us use and enjoy, I'm quoting from them, the internet without unfair interference from internet service providers. The rules will keep providers from blocking or slowing traffic or speeding up traffic for those who pay. Now, of course, it's true that this might be fought more, but at least there was a success in the courts, and that was kind of nice to see. Brian, looks like it's time for self-driving cars.
So I have been really excited about self-driving cars for a long time now, and I keep listening and reading people that say, hold on now, everybody's got to calm down. This is going to take a long time. Sure, Google has their own self-driving car driving around Mountain View right now, but it needs these incredibly detailed 3D maps in order to be accurate. And we're a long way away from a self-driving car that can just go out on an unknown road across America. So that's got me thinking a lot. And then I went to this party last week while I was up in San Francisco. You know, there's a lot of parties around the WWDC, and this one was thrown by Uber.
Ooh.
Now Uber as a company, there's a lot of things out there that I have heard. It makes me a little bit nervous about the company, but this was a interview with the chief product officer of the company and his
Did
ideas.
Did you get his permission to talk about this on the radio, on the podcast?
I did not sign anything, and I did not see anything.
All right, about that. Let's tell us what he said.
So what was really interesting about it is his vision for how quickly we're going to have self-driving cars. And of course, he's coming from the point of view that he's got his company has a financial interest in getting these on the road and making use of them. Because he believes once you get down to automated cars and ride sharing, you could go from something that now costs, in the range of $20 or $30 to go so many miles. He thinks that can get down to about 37 cents just by having an automated car be able to take the shortest route to help three people get along that route.
Mm-hmm.
These kind of efficiencies are amazing to think about. And once you get down to that level, of course, a really expensive self-driving car starts to make sense because mm-hmm. you're not paying a wage to the driver.
Well, but there's so many other benefits of a self-driving car in this situation that you don't need to take advantage of anything about the human being, right? That the person it can drive all the time,
right?
It's going to do efficiencies in fuel purchase or fuel charging or purchasing when it needs to, but completely part of the calculation. Like all of the features of the vehicle are akin and attuned to what its service needs are, not other things that might occur in a human's life, right? So unfortunately, the benefit is that robot is always doing driving and nothing else.
Yeah.
Right? And then, of course, the efficiency that Uber can already do with ride sharing, potentially the other side effect of this would be that if people are really comfortable with robots picking them up, maybe they're comfortable with sharing a ride more so than not, right? Like normally if I take an Uber, I interact with a driver, but instead there's not going to be a driver there and I share a cab with somebody. That's very comparable to being with the driver, right? But of course I can reduce costs because there's two rides being served at the same time. So did he really think that this is like something that's going to happen? Like,
I he seems to believe it, but I don't know.
Is he trying to hire you?
No. it's easy to get caught up in a lot of hype, but I just think it's fascinating to start talking about what the incentives are. And when you start thinking about the financial incentive to make this thing work, it could be a lot quicker than people fear. It's not just a technology problem. It's how much money can you throw at this problem to solve it? And a company like Uber that seems to be in the mode of let's see, what's a good way to put it? Packet switching of atoms around the Earth. They've got an incentive to do this.
Packet switching fleshy atoms. Keep in mind,
fleshy
the
atoms.
Whole keeping people surviving is important. You can't just shoot people in cannons. So, okay, if you look at this trend, if you assume that within 20 years we will have almost all self-driving cars, and assuming self-driving cars are a lot safer than humans, there'll be a lot less interaction, less bumping into people, you probably want to de-invest in body shop repair. Don't get into that market. And of course, any driving service, truck driving or people driving like cabs. Well, I mean, all these things are going to go away within our children's lifetimes, right?
Right. And texting behind the wheel and all of that as well.
Well, no, you'll be able to text whenever you want because the vehicle takes care of the driving for you. There is going to be the side effect of whole industries going away in some ways. It's kind of scary. I mean,
sure.
I can see that scare.
Well, whole areas of employment, not the industries. The trucking industry still exists. It's just not employing truck drivers.
That's a really creepy way of saying it. I feel like we've talked about this before. And I'm all optimistic and hopeful.
Well, my whole takeaway from this was not that anything has changed in the technology. It's just that the financial incentive to make this stuff happen could be a lot quicker than a lot of people, a lot of the naysayers out there are saying. And it's exciting. It's exciting to think about it. I don't want my daughter to get behind the wheel. I want this to happen sooner than later.
Of course, right now, Uber does not own the vehicles that are driving for it. The people do. And therefore, they don't have to invest in a vehicle. They can get a new vehicle because someone decides they want to start working for Uber. And like 2 weeks later, they're working for Uber, or maybe even sooner than that, right? So adding vehicles to the fleet is almost non-existent in price for Uber, except for the training and the potential risk. But when you're dealing with self-driving cars, Uber's going to have to buy those vehicles and build those vehicles and maintain those vehicles. So there's going to be a whole other expense model that they currently don't have, and therefore he's probably calculating wrong. That's my guess, is that at least in the first few years when you pay for all these vehicles, you're going to have – that's a lot of money to spit out there, and therefore you're going to have to recoup that over time.
Yeah, but that's what credit is for. And if you have lower liability with regard to the issue of are Uber drivers – you know, assaulting their passengers or vice versa. And the, how is insurance going to be handled? Whose insurance covers it? Yes, Uber's insurance could be covering it, but presumably there would be a much lower risk than the equivalent human driver.
And also on top of that, if they're talking about going from a $20 cost to a $37 cost, they just drop the price to $10 and then they're making money, a lot more money anyway. so in some regards, It makes sense for them to invest seriously in credit and buy a whole bunch of these vehicles. Yeah. So that's the kickstart, right? That's the thing that would say, well, we're just going to make a crap load of robotic vehicles because Uber can make a lot more money and just not hire people anymore.
Yeah, and so it starts with the cities, and all of a sudden the area at which these cars have the technology to drive in will start expanding, and the prices will come down not just in the cities, but as you get in the outlying areas and once you start attacking mass transit as a similar problem.
So I guess if you're an Uber driver, enjoy the time now while you have it.
Yeah.
And then you have... Get into robotics.
Yeah. Then you get a further collapse of the middle of the economy because you have middle class not being able to find a job for it, which means you don't have the same people paying for it, which means that the Uber vehicles may end up being more for people who have – that are in the upper echelons of wealth to begin with. And
do you think of an Uber driver as middle class?
Yes.
What does an Uber driver make? I don't even know.
They may not make much, but they have the funds to be able to have a vehicle and maintain a vehicle and, you know.
Middle class.
Yes.
All right. So you consider middle class like owning a vehicle in the U.S.?
Owning a vehicle, owning a smartphone, having an internet connection to manage that, having a bank account.
Those
are a lot of hallmarks of middle class. Yes, it's possible if you are in poverty to be able to do these things, but not
really
very
challenging. Yeah. So you're kind of thinking of middle class and poverty. There's a boundary of interest there.
Yes.
To you?
Yes.
Okay. So you're not talking like middle class, lower middle class, upper middle. You're not doing that. You're just saying the middle class, people can afford to live and pay for their things.
I'm one of those proponents of you build an economy middle out, not from top down.
Yeah. Okay. Good. All right. Miles, we got one more story, and I'm hoping that you've got a vehicle story of some sort since we're talking about Uber.
Yes. Turns out if you buy a Tesla Model S, you also bought a boat.
Whoa. What?
Yeah, he's giving away free boats. No.
And you get a boat. You get a boat.
Everybody gets boats.
That's one heavy boat, though.
When you,
$150 rowboat.
When you have an internal combustion engine and you try to drive through a flooded area, chances are water's going to get into the engine doesn't run anymore, and you're stuck.
Yes.
And
in fact, you can take a Land Rover and you can take the exhaust and the air intake and put them on tubes above the engine.
Snorkels.
And that's why those vehicles have snorkels. So they can go through mud and dirt and go up to waist height or a little bit deeper.
Right. And they also have a passenger area that has been sealed.
You kind of need that too.
Yes. Well, it turns out Tesla Model S's are generally sealed, and so when you're flooding, you can just go through, and they don't have internal combustion engines, which means they don't have any engine to get flooded.
Yes.
And so for short periods of time, the Tesla Model S can float well enough to be a boat and have its wheels turning. The treads will give it enough motion to be able to have forward progression.
So it's not rated for submersion.
No.
Now, the thing I would worry about here is all the electronics in that thing.
They're all well sealed because you don't want to have those electronics exposed to air either. They're lithium ion batteries. They're sealed.
But the battery pack is 375 volts. Are you saying that the battery train is all sealed perfectly? Because like normally in a car, the voltage is, you know, like if you submersed it, the battery would...
They would burst into flame upon contact with air.
No, I'm talking about the contacts. I'm talking about the actual metal contacts outside the battery housing. The differential voltage for a Tesla is 370 volts.
They are all sealed.
So they have to be sealed. Okay.
Yes.
That kind of makes sense. I mean, you definitely want them safe from touching because that would be bad.
Right.
And of course, a car battery doesn't matter as much because 12 volts, I mean, you can take... Dealing with the air intake for the gasoline, you can submerse a gasoline engine with snorkels and have the battery and the regulator and all that submersed as well. And unless you had really... the 12 volts is not going to do much through water, basically, right? Unless it's really rich in some kind of ionized particle. So basically, you could submerse a car battery and still start it. So that's not a problem. But with 370 volts, that's a different thing because that would actually probably cause a lot of drain on the battery through the water. In any case, so it's sealed. That's cool. How long can it... So does it float itself or is it more like you could do this across a small stream?
It does
like,
float as long as you don't have, you know, windows open or something like that where the water can get into the passenger compartment quickly. But that's true of some other vehicles too.
Yeah.
So this is a case where I don't know if the Teslas have this, but Priuses are often sold with low friction tires. You get a few more... miles per gallon. So low friction tires in this case are not going to get you as far.
Right, you want snow tires to really get your grip or to get your paddling going.
Excuse me while I go put chains on my tires.
You know, the other thing I was thinking about is the air intake for the passengers, right? They have to breathe air. But I know the Teslas have buttons on them that allow you to go through smelly environments. It's called
biohazard.
And that basically closes off the vents.
Yeah, but most cars have that, the little vent.
Yeah. But if you have water pressure on the outside.
Recirculating air, yeah.
But
yeah.
If you have water pressure on the outside, that's going to push through those pretty quickly.
Bear in mind, this is not a boat. This is for short periods of time, but it makes it so that when you're trying to plow through some water, that your engine doesn't stall and leave you in the middle of a flood zone.
Right. And the other aspect of this that comes to mind right away is that, of course, the compartment with the people in it is relatively sealed because you want low volume noise from the outside. Like you want a quiet environment. And to do a quiet environment, you basically make airtight and then that's quiet. That is really friggin' cool.
That's really cool. And don't go trying to cross those rivers on your own and they're in your Tesla.
Yeah, no cross Atlantic treks in a Tesla S. You'll run out of battery too quick.
But now somebody own a Tesla and you drive it into a lake. Sorry.
Yeah,
not a lot of hate.
You know somebody's not going to go modify and put a little propeller on the back.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Just heavy weather patterns were street floods.
Absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. I used to live in an environment like that. Would have been very useful. Of course, if I could afford a Tesla, I wouldn't have lived there. So, Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know we said hello. Thanks to our intern, Chandler. Our patrons, Chris Irwin and Pat Hedder. And also, because I haven't updated the website for a while, I want to do a special call out to thanks of other patrons. Jonas, Joe, what do you think? How do you pronounce that name?
Spider.
Spider. Good. Thank you. Brandon, Bradley, Manuel, Jeffrey, and Double. Thank you all for contributing. If you'd like to join them, go to geekspeak.org/support. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Unfortunately, Greg's not with us this week, so he wasn't able to give us a title for the show for the episode 25 of our 16th season. But we'll have it up on our website very soon. Brian Young, thank you for being here with me.
Oh, this is fun. Thank you.
And Mr. Miles Elam, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Was there any post-show stuff you wanted to say? I know you had a lot of stories.
Yeah. There's a game developer, Barbie. People are kind of cool with it.
So you know what's funny about that game developer, Barbie? You know the whole Gamergate thing surrounding, what's her, Space Cat Girl? Brianna Wu. If you take a look at pictures of the Barbie and Brianna Wu, they look remarkably similar.
Interesting.
Let's see.
Is this the Barbie's profession as gamer?
Yes.
No.
A game developer. Yeah.
So she got like a laptop.
Oh yeah. She's got a bag, laptop. was it purplish magenta red hair and
headphones with
a mic
and yeah. South Australian government is in a fight with software because they have some their health records are done on a program written on MS-DOS. It was installed in hospitals in the early 90s, and now the company who makes it wants them to stop using it because the license expired and they don't want to renew it and they don't want to maintain the software, and the South Australian government refuses to upgrade because, you know, that would cost money.
It would cost money, yeah, sure.
And so now they're in a court battle over that.
Well, how long is their software license good for? Like indefinite?
See, that's the thing, though, is all software requires maintenance, requires some support, especially because the hardware that they purchased for that software isn't made anymore. So having to make it compatible with newer stuff because you're not buying 386s anymore becomes an issue.
But are the developers legally obligated to keep developing?
There's the question, because the government's position is that they're putting patient safety at risk if they're forced to stop using that software system.
Or maybe hospital...
Because they standardize over the entire area.
Maybe the hospital is putting safety, putting patient safety at risk by using a DOS program.
Well, that's one of those cases of if it works, why switch it out? That's their position.
Miles, one of the things that we didn't get to was an amazing title that I saw in your feed of stories, and that is that the U.S. is actually powering up this first nuclear reactor for a long time, right?
Yep.
It's been like 40 years?
Where is this a new reactor, or are we turning another one online? An old one, the one that got shut off?
No, it's a new reactor.
Where?
First one in the country since its sister reactor was licensed in 96.
Wow, where?
Let's see here. Tennessee.
So I'm because I grew up in like a hippie commune kind of environment in Santa Cruz Mountains, I am predisposed to go, yay, nuclear, because so many people are spew a lot of lies and
nuclear
and hate about it. So I fight back that. So I'm aware of my own bias or opposite bias of that. But in my perspective, if I look at all the different sources of energy we currently have, it's of course not the ideal, but it's a lot better than coal. That's my general feeling. And since most of my power comes from coal or natural gas, which is of course also pretty much bad.
I thought ours comes from gasoline.
I thought it was natural gas, not gasoline.
In our area, I think oil is a major one. Not much coal at all in California.
Yeah.
So to my mind, that's actually probably improvement. Your thoughts on that, Miles? Brian?
I've always been bullish on nuclear power. I believe that we are making...
Nuclear.
Okay, I've power. Never been able to hear this difference.
I can't hear it either. That's why I did it to him. I wasn't sure.
I thought I said nuclear.
What do you think I said?
Nuclear. You did say nuclear.
So the difference is...
How do you hear the difference?
Nuclear and nuclear?
Yeah. One is how the word is spelled, one is not.
Okay, I got to spell the word so I can read it.
At any rate, solar power has been making leaps and bounds. Wind power to a lesser degree. I think solar has been making a greater increase over time. Most improved player, I believe, is what I would refer as solar. But they're still both very small relative to
our
the incumbents.
Yeah. And what we actually use, yeah.
So I never considered it just a – we should do the renewable energies versus the non-renewables. For me, it's always been an equation of how do we offset one with the other.
Mm-hmm.
And nuclear – because I consider global climate change to be the single biggest threat on the horizon, and lowering CO2 levels is a priority. Yeah,
right.
Is paramount importance that nuclear power – doesn't emit CO2, and it does have drawbacks, not the least of which are cost and the issues with regulations. It goes both ways. I think they're overregulated in some ways and not watched close enough in many other areas. And the fact that we can't enrich our nuclear material after the fact and reuse it,
which
instead
is really close.
Is
a lot of our waste
a relic
has to
of
do
the 70s that right. I believe is
a lot of our storage problems with nuclear waste is that we don't use it further. But in any case, let's not go into that anymore. I want to go home.
Yeah.
Okay. Guys, thanks so much. That was awesome. Nuclear?
Nuclear.
Nuclear.
What's the wrong way to say it, so I just don't do that?
Yeah, say it the wrong
nuclear.
Way.
Nuclear.
What's, there is no the U. Where's that sound coming from?
Nuclear.
Well, there is a U. But you're talking
no
about
more,
after
no
the
more
C.
Nukes. So people say nuclear.
Nuclear. So they put a U between the C and the L?
Yeah.
Nuclear.
But at the nuclear. Same time, I'm being a snob because, you know what, a good portion of the country has said nuclear, and it's we say a lot of things that don't look like the words, so I should just give up on that one. I was just poking fun at you.